Our next presenter. Mr. Frederick Baker III from the University of Tampa.
Hello.
We welcome you.
It's going to take you just a second.
Okay.
So I work at the University of Tampa now, but I'm actually from the University of South Oak. And I graduated the instructional design program in 2014. Some of these awesome people. And what Dr. Borscher was saying actually ties in really, really well with open education. So open education, we'll get into it, but it's changed a lot. The meaning has changed a lot. The ideas behind what open education or this alternative approach to education means has changed a lot. But if you think about what Dr. Borscher said, what he was talking about, for those of you who aren't in here, he has his students participate in authoring a paper in every step of the paper throughout the entire course in multiple semesters. And that bridges the traditional gap, the border of your classroom, right? Your students are connecting with experts, they're connecting with research, they're getting hands-on, they're getting outside of the borders of their traditional class. So keep that stuff in mind as we talk about this. Okay, so my goals here, some of this I'm going to drop a lot of names, and I don't expect you to pick them all up. I hope that you'll see one and say, that's interesting, I'll go look into that person. The goal here is to provide a simple way to think about openness, because it's very, there's a lot of different angles to it. To sort of skim the breadth of openness, especially over the last 100 years and how that applies, and hopefully to spur you to start thinking about how to design for openness in your courses. Just like Dr. Borscher is doing in some of the ways that we'll talk about as well. So what is open education and why? So if you'll take just about 20, 30 seconds and kind of think to yourself what openness means. What is it? What is openness in anything to you? Feel free to say it. I was going to have a worksheet, but I didn't want to drag it on. But does anybody have any ideas of what openness might mean to you?
Accepting,
right? That's great, right? Accepting of things, of people, of ideas, of
effective filter.
Right, there you go. So we've got filtering, we've got accepting, we've got
space,
right? Space is good, right? It's you've got a space to work, space to move. I think another thing that you might get into is freedom and agency, and that's some of the stuff that you see when you get into the literature, right, is this humanization, because a lot of times when we teach, we tend to say, okay, well, I've got this book to cover, and I've got this test to give, and I've got this concept to run, and we forget to say, well, how is this student, how do they fit in this, what are they hoping to get out of this, where are they going to go, you know, so we have to think about that experience, and we all love our students, but we really have to build that in. From the ground up, and part of love, right? Nobody likes to be suppressed or run through a system. If I were to just stand here and read PowerPoint slides to you, you would hate it. And so you have to really think about that experience and think about that love, right? What would this experience be like for someone if I love them and I care for them? And trust is huge, right? Because I have to trust you to be able to do your own thing. I have to trust that you're going to take an honest stake in your own learning experience, that you're really going to try to do your best, right? And that doesn't always happen. It's probably one of the number one things you hear is like, well, this 10% is really great, but like 90% are just sitting there looking at Facebook. And so I don't know that you can completely escape that, but I would challenge you and I would argue that at least some of the fault there, and Stephanie's going to laugh, is due to the instruction, right? Some of the fault there is because we have to come sit in a room for 8 hours a day and run to the bathroom really quickly and grab our books from the locker, and for 12, 15 years we tell them, sit down, shut up, do what I tell you. Mm-hmm. Then they get here and we say, well, why aren't they thinking critically and, you know, diversely, and why don't they tackle problems? Because they're waiting for me to tell them instructions. And I think that's the idea behind open education is to try to get around some of that and get them involved in learning. So, two concepts here sort of rise above the rest. One is transparency. When you think about transparency, and this is where I get to the simple definition of openness. When you think about transparency, you need to be able to see. If you think about it as a system or an instruction, you need to be able to see all parts of that system, Right, you need to be able to access it. You need to be able to know where things are, know how your teacher thinks, know what the limits of the assignment are, those kind of things. The other thing is freedom. You have to be able to own it, right? It's got to be yours. You have to be able to see it, and you've got to have permission to use it. So that's another consideration, right? You know, it's one thing to walk them through the process, but it's another thing to say, here's how you're going to do it, and you're going to do it, right? So that's a big difference, I think. Digging into these a little bit, talked about this visibility throughout the system and access throughout the system. So being able to see and being able to access. And then with freedom. Freedom's a little, it's interesting, right? Because you think about freedom, I have the freedom to do things, but you also think about freedom as the absence of restraint, right? You're no longer bound by the traditional role. So think about ways that you might release restraints, release barriers to participation in your course, and we'll talk about it briefly in a second. And the other thing is to build agency in. So that's another concept of freedom. So not only do you own it, but you're free to use it the way that you want, the way that you see best. So how do these things apply to your classroom, right? How do these conceptions of openness, how might you build these into your classroom? How would you tie them in? What are some things you can have them get hands-on with their papers and walk through the actual process of learning to be rather than learning about scholarship? Does anybody else have any ideas? Learning.
You would have to have some kind of open-ended concept or question for them to explore.
Yeah, give them sort of a mission and let them define it on their own. That's a good strategy. Learning contracts can be this way, right? And if you think about this, one sort of caveat I'll tell you is that there's open, right? There's open as in, this is yours. I wrote this book and you can just mark it up, change it, edit it, resell it, change it, whatever you want to do. And then there's open down here on the other end of the continuum, right? Which is not quite the Coca-Cola formula, but it's like you have some freedoms. So maybe in your class you say, here's 600 points and you determine whether they go to quizzes or tests, right? Or this project. Or maybe over here you say, okay, well, what do you want to learn and how are you going to make that happen, right? What are the objectives that you want to meet and what's your plan for getting there? So it's this continuum, and there's all types of room to build toward openness, toward transparency and freedom in your course. So again, the concepts from the literature are choice, right? You get the choice of where you move and what your role is, agency. Authenticity, right? We want to teach them to be rather than teach them about. So if we're in an architectural program, the idea is that they're learning about tolerances and they're making designs and they're looking at research, right? And they're actually gathering real data, doing a real business plan for a real business, those types of things. And if you can't get toward that, move toward case studies, right? Because that's not this level of authenticity, but it's here, which is better than taking a quiz, maybe. And the other thing is just this sort of this fun, this authenticity, this life, right? They need to be able to participate in that in a way that's important to them. So roots, openness, we think about MOOCs, right? We think about open data. You hear all these things about open source software, right? Because it's really big right now. And a lot of the biggest proponents say, well, it started in the 80s with the open source movement. Has anybody heard that? MOOCs and those things, they started in the 80s, but they didn't. They actually started at least a couple of thousand years ago, right? This concept of openness with Socrates, right? He talks about inquiry and discovery in his teaching. Plato and Aristotle, which that's embarrassing, right? So I'll just point that out. But they talk about attention to the whole person, right? The whole child, which is another thing to think about, right? We're in college. These aren't kids. These are adults. So, you know, think about that. We need to think about this whole person and how we're gonna involve them in this value of play. If you think about that, the value of play, humans play when we have fun, right? And if you never see your students smile, and you never see them play, and they have no room to wiggle and make that their own experience, then just consider that, and maybe make that a goal. How can I let them have some freedom? How can I have them just really smile at this? So this is interesting because you know, it's from a couple of thousand years ago, but it sort of encapsulates one of these. This is really big in the 60s and 70s, this concept of like oppressive instruction and like freedom and agency. In the 60s and 70s was big. But it's enforced exercise does no harm to the body, but enforced learning will not stay in the mind. So avoid compulsion and let your children's lessons take the form of play. You can force them to exercise, but you can't force them to learn. So this concept of openness is really, it's sort of this holistic approach to education. So there are other movements, the monastic border transformation. There's this paper where they start talking about how the monks were starting to move into the coffee houses, starting to bring information and knowledge to society in those ways. The Enlightenment period, right, where openness is considered a virtue. So that's some history there, and I know you can't read this chart, so I try to make it a little bigger. This is from a study from Peter and Deiman, D-E-I-M-A-N-N, and they did this history of openness, right? And so they broke it down. There's the late Middle Ages, where you've got things like urbanization and increased mobility, this Renaissance to Industrial Revolution, so you've got globalization, you've got the more Industrial Revolution, you've got increased literacy rates, into the modern era, you've got population growth, things like that. And then postmodernism, which we're in now, you've got this overabundance of information, this globalism, this globalization has grown. And so here are some of the things that they charted. And so in the, up to the 1500s, you get the Gutenberg press, right? You get the portable books, you get public lectures. Moving on, you get the coffee houses. This is the monastic border traveling, right? Rail networks, postal service, University of London system, different universities, open university. You've got TV, computers, internet, wiki, YouTube. Now over here, you've got iTunes, open learning. You've got MIT, right? MITx and edX, which are MOOC platforms, and Coursera, and all those things, which is big. But we're going to worry about mostly this last 100 years or so, because this is, you know, what we came for. So here's this really cool quote. We do not learn from experience, we learn from reflecting on experience. Does anybody, I don't have any peppermints or candy to throw at you, but if you, this is John Dewey, right? So this guy talked about experiential learning and reflection. Enabling democracy was one of the big things that he was concerned about, right? We need to learn to create citizens, and the way that people learn to be competent citizens is through experience and through reflecting on experience. So that's good. Here's another one. I don't love this quote very much, but I think it's interesting. The greatest sign of success for a teacher is to be able to say, the children are now working as if I did not exist. And I think that one's kind of hard for a lot of us to take, right? Because it's like, why am I here? I think, and I can't speak for it, but I think the idea here was to, and if you think about education as a whole, to take these humans, and they're very dependent, and you have, there's lots of scaffolding, there's lots of control, and we have to teach them to be independent. So by the time they're in eighth grade, there's a little less hand-holding and a little less spoon-feeding. By the time they're in 12th grade, they should be able to write a paper and do some, you know, basic competencies. And you move into college and you start building on those skills, and there's a lot less spoon-feeding, right? And sort of, well, if you didn't make it to class, you didn't make it to class, and you've got some remedial instruction societally back here. So that's interesting, right? If you think about it in those terms, I think it's important to move toward teacher not existing, right? So that's Maria Montessori. She talks about play. She talks about discovery learning. Let's see. I've got one more for you. And this one, I bet nobody guesses. Insofar as a scientific statement speaks about reality, it must be falsifiable. And insofar as it is not falsifiable, it does not speak about reality. So this is the scientific method, if you think about this, right? This is, we have to be able to falsify things, and if you can't falsify them, then you can't say they're true or not true. So this is Karl Popper, right? In the 20s and 30s and 30s and 40s, he wrote Open Society and Its Enemies, did a lot of philosophy, but the reason he's here is because he's got this, he's considered the father of open thinking, right? There's positive and negative freedoms in his work, and so the positive freedom is the freedom to act and to grow, and the expectation is that you can be a functional, contributing member of society because you're competent. And the other thing is negative freedom, right? So it's freedom from interference and coercion. This is societal. But he had educational ideas that mirrored that, right? So Popperian education focused on enabling democracy, creating competent people through negative and positive freedom, through teaching you to think critically, to be able to falsify false ideas and support things with evidence and become what a lot of people would consider the basic functions of educated instruction, right? You have to be able to support your ideas with evidence and to understand when you're speaking fallacy. So open education here is sort of this means to enable democracy. It's also a way to engage learners with respect to their humanity. So in the 60s and 70s, there's Seymour Papert, right? And this is where I get into just spitting a bunch of names out. Hopefully you've heard of these people. If you haven't, I recommend going and look them up. But I'll give you just a little bullet point on each one. Seymour Papert, 60s and 70s, who's heard of the logo programming language, the turtle? K-12 teachers, that are older, the idea was there was this turtle, and you could learn to program it, and it would teach you math or geometry because you could move up three spaces and pick the pen up and move over two spaces and that. So he did co-construction, right? He did this, these models, these things are ideas, they're objects to think with, right? We can get our head around these complex ideas by immersing ourselves and getting hands-on. Bell Hooks, open our education, not open education, is the practice of freedom, right? Paulo Freire, liberation pedagogy in Brazil. Carl Rogers, right, with the freedom to learn, if you think about that, becoming the whole person and that. Ivan Illich, so learning webs, right, a lot of this thing that we have, personalized learning networks and those kind of concepts, or he wrote about in the late 60s, early 70s in a book called Deschooling Society. He talked about institutionalization and the fact that there are schools, I mean, leading to the idea that we're going to continue to need schools, because sort of, in a nutshell, what happens is you've got a school, so everything learning related becomes the school's job, right? So like we don't have, he made the same argument with hospitals, like there's no need for me to know anything about basic poison treatment because I've got the hospital or whatever. So those ideas are important. More open educational generally revolved around freedom and trust and agency. We're starting to get into this book here, Lillian Stevens, which is probably one of the best books I've read. It's The Teacher's Guide to Open Education, and it's this really, it provides a great timeline, for one thing, in the beginning, and it's a K-12 setting, right? So it's for face-to-face classroom. This book is from 1974. It's like $1.50 on Amazon. Everything in it's not still relevant, but if you start thinking about it, it really captures sort of the concepts and the feelings behind open education. You have reading centers, you have people connecting with the community in here, you have students building agency into their daily activities, you've got all of that stuff.
Who's the author again?
I'm sorry, Lillian S. Stevens, and it's The Teacher's Guide to Open Education. Wonderful book.
Thank you.
So the free school movement, Summerhill and all those places, come on in. There's you look at things like agency, right? There's more democratic participation in your own learning. So open plan schools, where we get into space, this concept of space, the idea was that we would build up large communal spaces where students, have you ever been in a classroom without walls, those types of things, where there's, and they don't work really well for standard teaching, right? They're horrible if I'm gonna stand up here and lecture because there's somebody else standing up there and lecturing right next to us. It's got a really bad reputation because people are using this space that's designed for one thing for something completely different. It's like using pliers to hammer a nail. It doesn't make any sense, right? So if you use an open plan school for the way it was intended, then it actually works pretty well. You've got not lecturing going on, but you've got small groups of students who are reading, who are making a project, who are taking care of the animals, who are building a library, doing some community project. Open education was really big during this time in the UK and in America. It was really growing in America. And then actually in the late 70s, early 80s, it just fizzled out. And then open society. So if you think about the integration of the schools, right? Very critical. They talked about openness. They talked about open society, this concept that like we don't need to impose one concept of education on everybody. We need to have a place where everybody can participate and everybody can bring their own little magic to this space to build it together. We all need to work together, and it needs to be a place where it's not oppressive, it doesn't stamp you into this molded, predetermined thing. It gives you a space to be your own, but it also lets you contribute to the environment. So not only it's not the environment's not shaping you, you're shaping the environment. And together we build an environment that works for everybody through transparency and freedom. So right here we've got open education as humanizing, as liberating, right? We're releasing people. It's respectful of the human being. It's a trusting place. We're building love and trust and authenticity. So we're getting into the community gardens, right? We're getting into writing papers. We're getting into those types of strategies. It's social, especially now, right? Where globalization is increasing, and now we're digitally global. So this is where this is going to take an interesting turn here in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of times people said, well, openness started in the open source movement in the 80s and 90s. But that's not really true. But what it did do was have this shift, right? Because up until now, openness was about freedom and trust and love and respect. But now it starts to shift. So free software, Richard Stallman, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but basically there was this printer code and the computer printer, and he knew how to fix it. It was giving him trouble, but he didn't have access to the source code. So he wasn't able to change it, right? So he didn't have the authority, the freedom, to change the printer code so that it worked. And it was a simple problem, and it was one that HP or whoever ran the printer, it was beneath their concern. It was like 10 people had to worry about it, and it really irked him. So he went on this movement, created this free software concept, where software is a human right, right? And then the Free Software Foundation, the idea that you should have access to creative control, ownership, agency, things should be transparent, they should be free, right? Computer software. But part of that actually tied into not only freedom, but free, as in gratis. So here's another, I'll point this out. I'm going to point out all the mistakes here. This one, I made that too high. So source code, right? So open source is a little bit different from free software. So free software is way down here. It's like absolutely free. Software is right. You have no right to change it. Open source is like, well, we have to integrate with society still, right? We have business concerns. We have things like that. So they're like, we want this source code to be able to be free. We want you to be able to change it. We want you to give you certain rights. But we're not going to go crazy and say, like, well, we're not going to use your driver because it's related to a commercial entity, because that's going to make our software pretty much unusable. So that's good. You've got things like Linux. There's another mistake, apparently. You get into open licenses. So general public license, right? So that's when you're starting to license software to the public. And this gets a little out there, but the idea is that I'm giving you freedoms, right? This is a contract. That I'm saying, if you use this software, then you have these things, you have these privileges, these rights. So there's also the open public license, which starts moving toward open content and outside of things strictly like software, but into things like books and videos and lectures and things like that. Mm-hmm. So here, openness, again, it shifts to include free as in gratis, free as in cost, right? Free as in you're not going to charge you, as well as free as in you're free to use this. So in the 2000s, this is dubbed the open decade, right? Because there are lots and lots of things going on here. MIT, OpenCourseWare, who's heard of that? Yeah. Basically, yeah, MIT just releases tons and tons and tons of their courseware, their lectures, all of these things online, free to the public. Right now there's OpenCourseWare. You've made open educational resources, freely accessible, transparent things to the world in education. We've got Creative Commons licensing, right? Who's heard of that? Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. There are six or so licenses. There's actually seven because there's a CC0, which releases a completely public domain. Come on in. But you've got basically every license requires attribution except for the public domain license. So that's the CC BY, right? Creative Commons BY attribution. And then they hinge on some other things. Share alike, this is a share alike license. I release it, you're allowed to use it. If you modify it, you have to release it under a same or similar license. There are other ones, creativecommons.org. You've got open content, right? So open educational resources, open textbooks, things like that. And they have five permissions. This is David Wiley and his concept. But you've got the ability, the right? You've got the freedom to retain your use. You've got the freedom to reuse it. Right, reuse the content as you see fit, to revise it. So I don't like chapter 3 in this open textbook. I'm going to take it out, or I'm going to change it. to remix it. So I like chapter 3 in this textbook and chapter 5 in that textbook, and I'm going to put them together. So I've got a new resource made out of two separate resources. And to redistribute it, right? So once I've done it, I'm going to give it to everybody for free. And you think about that. You think about that in terms of a textbook, a lecture, a concept, your rubric for your class that you spent the last 3 years perfecting, right? And you think about that. And then think about how nice it is to release that to people, if you want to. Because it gives them that rubric that you've been working for 5 years on. Now they can just pick it up and start using it, make their own modifications, and add things that you might not have considered. Open access research, which is the idea of transparency and freedom applied to research. You have freedom and rights to access it and use it as you see fit. Open teaching and learning. Connectivism, which is this idea that information is, knowledge is stored in nodes and networks, and that the way to, that one of the most effective learning concepts is to connect people with as many nodes as possible. That when you get into massively open online courses, the idea that you've got students participating in this world wide web, sort of laissez-faire as far as the rules go. Open scholarship, so we're getting into those types of things. Open source software becomes mainstream, like Firefox and those things. 2012, so I'm going to rush a little bit. 2010, so now we've got the year of the MOOC in 2012 when there was all that hype about what MOOCs are. The institutionalization of openness, because openness is now not about freedom and even free as in cost. Now it's about collecting data, right? Now we've got Coursera, Udacity, they want to collect data. You've got these people experimenting with openness as a platform, which is really interesting. You've got regulation, governmental regulation, saying if we've got federally funded research, it needs to be released open access. There's this huge debate on whether an LMS is abusive or not, or okay to continue using versus open web, because you'll never have a better Twitter platform than Twitter, and you'll never have a better blog platform. Learning management systems, so like here we use Sakai, other places use Blackboard, other places use eCollege, those type of things. The idea is, you know, they're very useful, right? Because you need to keep institutional data, you've got to retain records, you've got to have a standardized platform that doesn't confuse the students, it's easier for the faculty to learn, those type of things. Very important to have an LMS. But at the same time, you're taking this infinitely complex behavior, humanity, and learning, and shoving it into this sort of pre-canned thing, and then all instruction comes out looking like this, instead of like this. So it's a legitimate debate, it's worth watching. Connected learning, which is sort of the modern version of open education. It's the idea that we're gonna trust our learners and we're gonna let them connect with digital resources, connect with other educators, other experts in the field, write their own blogs, those types of things. Personal learning environments, digital ecosystems, digital literacy, digital micro communities, which is this idea where we get just a couple of people that we know who are maybe researching the same things and we're connected with them through online and we read papers and we nerd out about research things. So here openness becomes a commercial interest, right? It's now a business thing. We've got a means to explore new affordances. So how do we build technology into classes in ways that it's useful? And then how can we test that with thousands of learners at once, right? So MOOCs get into that. So openness, where it's influencing now and where I expect it to go in the next 20 years, social constructivist learning is huge, right? It comes, a lot of that, those concepts come from this approach of education as loving, trusting, let them have be free, let them engage. And the idea is that they're going to learn to be competent. They're going to learn fluency in their discipline by acting in that discipline. Studio model learning, which I'm a huge fan of. The idea is that we're all going to get together, we're going to create something, we're going to critique it, we're all going to learn from each other's mistakes and each other's work and each other's ideas, and then we're going to redesign it and move forward. Authentic assessment, right? Having them actually do a paper, having them do an actual business plan, all of those concepts. Project-based learning, those things fit really well. Connected learning, which there's this huge body of research starting to build around connected learning. The University of Mary Washington is getting into this. University of the Commonwealth, Virginia Commonwealth University is another. Self-directed learning, discovery learning, making and constructionist learning, those types of concepts fit really well with these ideas that we've been talking about at Open Education. Where I see it going, and there's sort of a caveat here, but I think by sort of shifting this ownership, the impetus to the learners for their own learning experience, and through providing them with the instruction, right, the part that we have to, the tools and the guidance to be successful in these areas, And being willing to give up just a little bit of control so that they can have it, so that they can learn, right? Because it's like a kid. I'll never forget, that I've got three young boys, and I was getting dressed all the time, and I always just, you know, you go to put their pants on, and then one day they go, hey, I can do this. And you're like, what? What do you mean you can do that? I can do this. But it's like, no, okay, I'm going to do it. And then they get their foot in there, and they fall over and stuff, but they do it. And like a month later, they're the boss at putting their own pants on. So we need to do that with education, right? We need to say, like, here, do it a little bit. You can do it. I'm here if you fall. I'll pick you up. So just sort of being willing to challenge our conceptions about what education is, what the borders of education are, what our roles in education are, then I think by doing that, we can really create some really impressive learning experiences for the students. And I think whatever this is, isn't set, right? I hope you weren't thinking that I was going to be like, it's going to look like X, because it's not. We're building it together, right? And so what openness is this permission to experiment. And these concepts, we're trusting you as a human being to take part in your own learning, and I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you trust. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to give you some freedom, and I'm going to help you, right? I want you to do certain things. It's not laissez-faire. It's not do whatever you feel like. It's not like you just make your own rules. You're going to have assignments. You're going to have concepts. You're going to have penalties. You're going to have all that stuff. But it's going to go a little further than, like, you've got a paper on the 12th, and you pick the topic, right? It's got to go a little further than that.
Time is up.
Yes, give me two. So I'm going to skip through this. I wanted to leave you with the concern was that we tend to go towards scalability, right? We tend to go toward this simplification. This quote, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So that's what I hope open education moves toward, is this new model. Thank you very much.
Thank you.